Welcome to Let's Get Physical. The material presented on this show are for educational purposes only and are not to be used as a substitute for medical advice from your healthcare professional.
Hello, this is Dr. Lauren Chin, and thanks for joining us today with Let's Get Physical. Today I was going to talk a little bit more about low back pain. I wanted to try to finish up that subject, but my office manager, Patty Murray, even though she's retired, still tells me what to do. And she suggested that I not harp on low back too much before people get bored. But we did talk about it a couple times. I would like to take just a few minutes and then we'll move on to something else. So we have been discussing in the past, I've been telling you about the discs and how they become distorted and they tear and they cause all kinds of issues. We didn't spend as much time as I would have liked telling you how to avoid that other than to preserve the curve, which is great advice if you know how to do it and what that means. So let's just take a minute and talk about how to preserve the curve when you are bending over. And let's face it, we have to bend over quite a bit. So what we want to do is try to preserve that curve. And so to do that when you're bending over, it helps if you take a wide stance. So spread those feet apart. Secondly, we bend at the knee. Yes, the knees bend. And then we hinge at the hip. We bend over, and what that means, if you are hinging at the hip and keeping your curve, it means you're sticking your butt out. Now, I know that isn't ladylike, but if you're not sticking your butt out, you're hurting yourself. So just think about it. Wide stance, bend the knee, hinge at the hip, stick the butt out. I'm telling you, it works, okay? And then when you are sitting to preserve that curve, we talked about the lumbar support, a pillow behind your low back, but I wanted to remind you that if you're sitting in an overstuffed recliner or sofa, that putting that pillow back there, you're just kidding yourself, because if your butt sinks into that sofa, your pelvis rotates posteriorly, that is, it goes backwards. Your pelvis rotates, and you have a reverse curve against that cushion. So what that means is you need to know where your pelvis is. And to get in touch with your pelvis, it helps to do what's called some pelvic tilts. You can lie on your back with your knees bent and flatten your back against the floor and lift your pubic bone up towards the air. That's a posterior tilt. Now, the opposite of that, you would kind of stick your stomach out or stick your navel up, lift it up, and rotate your pubic bone downward. That is an anterior tilt. And so if you just get comfortable with your pelvis and know what it's doing, you need to become familiar with that, because otherwise this stuff sneaks up on you. You sit down someplace, you're thinking about the big game or the movie or whatever, you don't realize what your pelvis is doing, and you get up an hour later and all of a sudden you have back pain, or you get up and you feel okay and you go to bed, and in the morning you wake up and you have that back pain. So let's try to get control of that pelvis. And lastly, before we leave this subject, if you are looking for a new car, I would encourage you. Oh boy. This may not be politically correct, but I would advise you to try to find a taller vehicle, something that's built like an SUV or a van or a pickup, as opposed to a low-slung sports car. Now, if you just bought yourself a new sports car, oh well. But if you're thinking about buying a car in the next year or two, consider getting something a little taller so that when you sit in it, you're sitting up more in a sitting position rather than a reclined position, because that's just a tough, it's just tough on your back. There's no good way to do that. So, all right, I think we're just about... Well, okay, yeah, let's move on. So from the low back, I wanted to move up into the mid back and then into the neck, because I know a lot of you folks have neck pain, and from there we'll go to headache, but maybe we should take a little detour to the hip, and then we'll see how much time we have after that. So hip pain is pretty common, especially after age 40. It becomes very common, and, you know, well, actually, we probably should talk about how to find the hip, because a lot of people don't really know where their hip is. But if you look in a mirror and you look at your belly button. Take a line, horizontal line, sideways line, from your belly button to the far edge of your torso, and poke around there. You'll feel a bone. You feel a bony ridge out there. That is the crest of the ilium, or hip bone. So from that point at the far edge there, take a line straight down to your crotch. So actually, it'd be a diagonal line to your crotch. Now, from that outermost point that we found, the crest of your hip, to the crotch, about halfway between there, make another point. That is roughly the location of your hip joint. So the hip joint is a ball and a socket. The hip bone, the femur, has a ball on the top of it that fits into a socket in your hip bone, in your pelvic bone. So from that socket, the bone doesn't go straight down. It angles outward at an angle, and then it comes in again. So now, again, if you look in the mirror and you look at the widest part of your hips, a few inches below that iliac crest, the widest point of your hips, that is something called the greater trochanter. It's a big hunk of bone on the outside of that femur or hip bone, and it provides a place for your muscles to attach. So if you grab your rear end, you feel there's a big hunk of muscle back there. That's several muscles. Those are the gluteal muscles. And they start up at the top of your pelvis and on your sacrum, and they travel downward and outward, or posterior oblique line, and they insert onto the greater trochanter. So that trochanter, that hunk of bone, acts as a place, attachment for all these muscles. And it is a frequent source of pain. So when you're looking in the mirror and you're wondering where, you know, why does this hurt, and you poke it and it makes you jump, that is, or in the past, has been called a trochanteric bursitis, because the body in all its wisdom put a little sack of fluid in there to try to protect the muscle insertions from rubbing on the bone. So historically, we thought that when a person, usually a woman, had pain. Why do I say that? Why usually a woman? Because pain in the trochanter, or trochanteric bursitis as it was known, is about five times more common in women than in men. And it's thought that the anatomical differences, the shape of the pelvis in a woman, predisposes her to trochanteric bursitis much more than men. And in my clinical experience, that was true, especially women with a very feminine type of figure. We're much more prone to trochanteric bursitis than very slender, narrow pelvic women or men, although that's not always true. And anyway, so people would come in, a woman would come in, and she'd say, you know, I got a pain in my hip. And they'd say, where's your hip? And she'd point to her trochanter. So I would do the examination. We have to do the examination. You have to go through the whole shebang, you know, the history, the physical, neurological, and then you get into the orthopedic testing. And if the range of motion of the hip was good, then we get down to palpation. And usually, you know, I'd have her standing. I would stand behind her or sit behind her. And with a couple of fingers, I would push firmly over that trochanter. And if that made her jump, or, you know, she expressed pain, then I knew that we had a trochanteric bursitis. Now, that's what we used to know. Now we know that it's rarely a trochanteric bursitis. The bursa is often inflamed, yes. The definition of bursitis is an inflammation of the bursa, right? But it's not that simple. Most of these are actually trochanteric tendonitis, because MRI studies have shown us that most of these cases, there is a problem with the tendon. And in fact, even tendonitis, I think most of you folks have probably heard the term tendonitis. That term is obsolete, again, because MRI has shown us that inflammation of the tendon, although it does occur, it's really nice when that's all it is, it's just inflammation. But many times, most of the time, the majority of cases, there is tendinopathy. Now, what is tendinopathy? P-A-T-H-Y, pathy, means disease of, or abnormal condition of. And So most of these problems have a tendinosis or a tendinopathy. So you have a woman with 15-year history of trochanteric pain, put her in an MRI scanner, and the odds are you will see partial rupture of one or more of the gluteal tendons. So the treatment is not so simple. I mean, if it were a simple tendinitis, what would you do? You give them, don't give them anything, but a person might take ibuprofen or put an ice pack on it and it would be fine, right? Well, it's not that simple and it rarely works that way. And those of you who have had chronic trochanteric pain, I'm sure you can attest to this. It's just not that easy. You can inject it with steroid and, sometimes that will help for a few days, but it almost always comes back. And why is that? If it's just an inflammation of the tendon or the bursa, why does it come back? It comes back because you have a tendinopathy or a tendinosis. There is partial rupture. There is fraying. There is mechanical disruption of the tendon fibers. So that makes it a lot more complicated. What do you do then? Well, and by the way, tendinosis or tendinopathy, this happens in the shoulder, happens in the elbow. So those of you who have been told that you have tennis elbow, go home and take ibuprofen. I'm sure you found that wasn't all that effective. An injection of steroid every once in a while, get a home run and it helps for 6 months or a year, but most of the time it helps for a couple of weeks and it comes back because you haven't addressed the underlying problem in the tendon. So how do you address that? Well, you see microscopic scarring, you see tearing, and so this is a matter of addressing this thing physically. And physically means physical therapy. I used to do physical therapy in the office. How do we do physical therapy on a trochanteric tendinitis or a tendinopathy or a tendinosis? Well, you have to get in there and try to work out the scar tissue, the little fibrotic changes in the tendon, and that's not very pleasant. You get in there and do deep stripping of the tissues, and that can be painful. Sometimes it helps if you ice it first and then you do the work, or you do the work and then ice it. But that almost always has to follow with strengthening exercises. And that's the key. If you don't do the strengthening exercises after the myofascial release, that's what it's called when you get in there and work out those knots or those scar tissues. And if you don't do the strengthening afterwards, you're just not going to get the results that you want. And this is it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, this takes some dedication. You have to persevere. You do it every other day for weeks and weeks. If you're lucky, 6 or 8 weeks, and it's pretty good. If you're not so lucky, or if you're not doing the whole program, then can't expect optimal results. So anyway, that's my take on trochanteric tendinosis. And, before we had MRI, we just assumed, we had to assume a lot of stuff because we just didn't know. We just thought it was a trochanteric bursitis. The MRI has been a real godsend. And for those of you who are younger and have just assumed that MRI has always been here and you take it for granted, I got to tell you, it wasn't always like that. I started practice in 77, and I don't even remember. I do remember in 78 or 79, there was a radiology group in South Seattle that bought an MRI. It was the first one in South Seattle. I went to the open house. It was a big party because we were going to have MRI. And we didn't really know what it was capable of. And in retrospect, it really wasn't capable of that much because in an MRI machine, I'm digressing now. So if I get lost, you reel me back in now, Truman. So with MRI, there are two main components of a magnetic resonance imaging scanner. Number one is the magnet. And this is a case where size matters because the bigger the magnet, the better image you get. And in those days, and magnets are measured in Tesla units. So I think in those days we had like a 0.25 or a 0.3 Tesla magnet. And so the magnet and the computer together put images together for you. So think back in 78, what computers did we have? They were so primitive. They were so primitive. My iPhone has about 1,000 times the computing power of the MRI in that machine. So the images that we got were, you know, pretty grainy and kind of hard to make much out. But these days, we have 3 and 4 Tesla magnets. The computers are enormously powerful. The images are just incredibly detailed. And even I can sometimes read an MRI. They're such good images. But anyway, now where were we? We're gonna... Oh, yes, the other... So right. So tendinosis of the hip, it's a bugger. It's very common. If you have it, if you have pain out there where I was just describing, the far lateral aspect of your hip, and it hurts right there, that's not your hip. That's your trochanter. Go to your doctor and hopefully he'll send you for physical therapy, because drugs alone, really not doing the whole job. Okay, so, but your hip, now we did talk about your hip. How do you find your hip? Well, that big mass of muscle that you sit on, those are your gluteal muscles, and we talked about where that ball and socket joint is. Now, when I had people come in and they had pain, and it was trochanteric pain, I would smile to myself, because that's very treatable. And I could treat that, provided I got cooperation from the patient and they were willing to do the exercises at home. Oh, and by the way, before we leave trochanteric tendinosis, you can have a person, well, I guess you could have a person come in 3 times a week. I never wanted people to come in that often. So, but you need somebody to do myofascial release and work those knots out of the gluteal muscles. So I would teach people how to use a foam roller at home. And the foam roller is a great tool, and they could roll their hip and then do the strengthening exercises. Now, a lot of times that thing is so hot, you can't sit, you can't line a foam roller. You try to line it, and people would just scream and fly off the roller and get stuck to the ceiling. So I would send a handheld myofascial roller home that their spouse could use on the hip for 1 minute per hip per day. And then they could do the strengthening after that, and got good results that way. But if they came in and I said, "Where's your pain?" And they would point to that spot that I showed you, that we discussed. If you take that line from the far lateral, far side of your hip, the far outside, and you take a diagonal from that point down to your crotch, halfway between, if they point there, then I would frown to myself, because that very likely would be coming from the hip joint itself, the ball and socket. And that's a lot tougher row to hoe. So, I mean, sometimes that pain can be coming from the spine. We talked about referred pain from the low back. It can send pain into the hip itself. And so, again, that's why we have to do the full exam. And you do the orthopedic exam, and we challenge that low back and put it through all kinds of ranges of motion and see if it reproduces pain in that inguinal region, as it's known, anterior inguinal region. And if it does, then maybe it's coming from your back and I can treat that. But if it doesn't, then we have to do the hip exam. So the hip exam, we have you lying on your back. And actually, sometimes we don't even have to do that. I just ask you, can you do your own toenails? No, haven't been able to do them for a year. Why? Just can't get my foot up there. Oh, okay. So if you can't do your own toenails, well, if you're overweight, you know, and your tummy's in the way, that's one thing. But if you're not overweight and your hip just doesn't do that anymore, you know, that's an indication that you might have disease in the hip joint itself, arthritis in the hip joint. So, and if it's been coming on slowly and you've just been having incrementally increasing difficulty in reaching your toes, then it may be osteo. So we put a person on their back and we have them flex the hip. See if you can bring your knee to your chest. How close can you get it to your chest? And compared to the other side, if the symptomatic side just doesn't come up as far, that's not so good. So then we get that hip up as far as it'll go and ask you to bring that knee across your chest to the opposite shoulder. Oh, no, that doesn't, it won't go there, doc. It just doesn't want to do that. Well, that's another sign that maybe this is arthritis in the hip joint itself. Then The third test, we would try to get the knee across to the opposite shoulder as far as it would go, and then I would grasp the ankle and pull the ankle out sideways or laterally away from the body. And if the person goes, no, you can't do that. That just doesn't want to do that, doc. Then, you know, I've already made the diagnosis, but we do the last test anyway. And that one, we have them put the foot, the symptomatic leg, we have them bend at the hip and the knee, put the foot on the table. They're lying on their back still. And then we have them bring the knee out as far as it will go. And if it doesn't want to go out very far, not as far as the other side, you know, that's pretty much a clincher. And then we straighten out the knee and then rotate the whole thing. And if it doesn't want to rotate, I already know. I know they have arthritis in that hip. And that's when we order the x-ray. And speaking of x-rays, you know, the way I was trained, this is my way of apologizing to some of you folks, but the way I was trained, we examine the patient, we make a diagnosis, a tentative diagnosis, and then you order the tests to try to confirm your diagnosis. You don't just have a patient walk in and then just order, you know, scattershot a bunch of tests to try to figure out what it is. You do the exam first, make a tentative diagnosis, and then order the x-rays. And I tried to only order x-rays when I really thought they were necessary and when I really thought that was going to change the treatment and really needed to confirm a diagnosis because it was going to affect the treatment. So there are two people out there I know of that I should have ordered x-rays on. Both of them were, let's see, one was a fractured hand. I missed a fracture of the hand. A lady fell off her horse. If you're listening, I'm sorry, because that was a delayed diagnosis by about a week or two. But you know what they say, the only x-ray you ever really regret is the one you didn't get. But on the other hand, you don't want to take x-rays, and you don't want to have x-rays taken of you unless they're really necessary, because they are dangerous, and they're cumulative. And, you know, you have a lifetime to accumulate that stuff, and if you get too many x-rays, then it's just not good. It causes cancer. So anyway, so once we have this tentative diagnosis, I'm already 99% certain this is osteoarthritis of the hip. We get the x-ray. We send the person out for x-rays. Now, here's where it gets difficult. X-ray findings with hip pathology are about 5 years behind the actual disease. So a lot of times people would come in and they would complain of pain in the inguinal region. I would do the exam, and maybe things weren't strikingly positive, but enough that I thought this was osteoarthritis, and order the x-rays. And the report would come back either essentially normal hip or minimal osteoarthritic changes in the hip. And then the patient would come back and they'd say, hey, the radiologist says you have minimal osteoarthritis of the hip. And the patient invariably would say, well, it doesn't feel so minimal to me. And then, you know, we would treat it the best we could. And a year or two later, maybe three, take another x-ray. And all of a sudden, the report comes back. Moderate to advanced osteoarthritic changes of the hip. So, again, like my dad always said, you treat the patient, not the test, because the test doesn't always tell you everything. And here's a classic example of that. I had a lady come in. She was 44 years old, and I'd been treating her since she was 14, so I knew this lady. And she had excruciating pain. And you know, I want to apologize to you guys out there because I tend to overuse the term excruciating, I know. And there's a difference between excruciating and exquisite. And last time we talked about the annular fissure, okay, that's exquisite. And this pain, I think, could be described as borderline exquisite pain. She came in and she would cry out with pain every time she took a step on this hip. I could barely go through the exam. Everything was positive. I called my local friendly orthopedist and I said, you know, I have a lady here with a hot hip. And he said, well, send her over. I sent her over. They took x-rays. And x-rays were normal. She came back. She said, he told me to take ibuprofen. My hip is normal. I examined her again. This hip was not normal. This exam was highly abnormal. And I wrote him a note and I said, her pain is inconsistent with her findings. And he sent her back, and he wouldn't see her. He told her to go home and take ibuprofen. And then it dawned on me that the note I sent him was misleading. What he thought I was saying was, she wanted narcotics. What I was really saying was, the x-rays don't explain her pain. So I had to call him, and I said, look, there's something very abnormal going on with this hip. I'm not sure what it is, but I know it's there. So he ordered an MRI. I don't know why I didn't, but he ordered an MRI. And the MRI showed an acute synovitis of the hip. Now, what is a synovitis? A synovitis is an inflammation of the sock-like covering called the synovium of the hip. Most joints have a synovium, and anytime you have a synovitis, you have serious pain, and this was serious pain. He saw that and realized that this woman probably had rheumatoid arthritis. She'd never had it before. This was the first sign of it. And that synovitis, it was very, very painful. And when you get that synovitis, if you can't control it, the inflammation in the synovium erodes the joint. And within a year, she had a hip replacement. So again, my dad always said, you treat the patient, not the test. That was a classic example. And then having learned from that one, I had one here on Vashon. A lady walked in with the same situation. And I was much more alert to it the second time around and called her primary and told her primary what I thought was going on. And sure enough, unfortunately, that one wasn't controllable either. And she required a hip replacement also within a year. But for those of us who have lower grade, just, and that's rheumatoid arthritis. That one can destroy joints in months. But osteo, it's a lot slower. And so you can try to slow that process down as best you can. And how do we do that? Well, primarily by strengthening the muscles around the hip to try to support the bone and the joint the very best that we can. And we hope for the best. Now, let's see, what do I have? 3 minutes left? Okay. 2 minutes. Okay, so what we want to do is everything that we can to help the cartilage to repair itself. Now, cartilage is in a constant state of disrepair. Every day you're breaking it down, but every day you're also rebuilding it. You have all these little chondrocytes, they're called, that go in and they repair the cartilage. So the trick here is to try to repair it more quickly than it's breaking down. So here's the kicker. What do you do when you have arthritis? You take aspirin, or you take ibuprofen or naproxen or any of those NSAIDs. So we already talked about the negative effects that NSAIDs have on your stomach and on your kidneys, and we mentioned that, but it's definitely hard on your kidneys. What we didn't talk about is the effect that NSAIDs have, all NSAIDs have, on the chondrocytes, those little cells that go in to try to repair that damaged cartilage. Every day they're trying to rebuild it and repair it. As soon as you take an NSAID, boom, those chondrocytes stop working. It's like they go on strike. It just paralyzes them. And so people who have arthritis taking this stuff every day, a couple times a day, their chondrocytes aren't working. The degradation of their cartilage becomes accelerated and the arthritis gets worse. There's the kick in the head for you. This is Dr. Chin wishing you good health and good luck.